Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Make sure not to miss a single podcast and subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite subscription service. The views expressed in this presentation are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Army, or Department of Defense.
Welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Ron Granieri, professor of history at the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College and podcast editor of the War Room. It's a pleasure to have you with us. From February 6th to the 8th, 2024, the U.S. Army War College hosted a Homeland Defense Symposium in which distinguished military and civilian leaders joined academic experts to discuss the problems of homeland defense in our current strategic environment. One of those speakers was the Honorable Melissa Dalton in her capacity as Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And Secretary Dalton has generously agreed to join us here on A Better Peace to discuss current strategic challenges facing those responsible for protecting the homeland against a growing spectrum of threats, as well as possible responses. The Honorable Melissa Dalton is performing the duties of Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, which covers the following portfolios: Indo-Pacific Affairs, International Security Affairs, Space Policy, Special Operations, Low Intensity Conflict, and Homeland Defense, Hemispheric Affairs. She was sworn in as our Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense and Hemispheric Affairs on March 4th, 2022, covering Arctic and global resilience, defense continuity and mission assurance, defense integration, and DISCA, along with the Western Hemisphere. She's a very busy lady, and we are delighted that she's taken the time to join us today on A Better Peace. Thank you for joining us, Secretary Dalton.
Delighted to be joining you all here today.
When I bring on a guest, especially one who's had as interesting a career path or is in as interesting a position as you are in, I want to start with a very basic question: is what led you to your current position in the government?
Well, thanks. I began really interested in public service. I come from a family of public servants, both military and career. And so that was kind of imbued within me growing up. And then, you know, when 9/11 hit, I definitely felt that call to service. And so I started at the Defense Intelligence Agency as an intelligence analyst. And from there, spent about a decade as a career civil servant, serving both in the Bush and Obama administrations. Got to a point where I had seen a number of foreign policy challenges that I felt needed a bit more examination from a research and analysis perspective. So I decided to leave government and join the Center for Strategic and International Studies for about 6.5 years, bipartisan think tank in Washington, D.C., and really focused on the nexus of defense policy, military operations, and the principled approaches that we can take in the application of military power around the world and here in the homeland. And when there was an opportunity to serve again as a political appointee this time, I was honored to join the Biden-Harris administration on the first day of January 20th, 2021, serving first in our Strategy Plans and Capabilities Office. And then, as you mentioned, had the honor of being confirmed by the Senate and appointed by the President to my current position as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland and Hemispheric Affairs. As we are at a point in the administration where some folks have decided to leave the administration, I've been asked to step up temporarily in the policy front office, working closely with Sasha Baker and the policy team.
Right. I mean, it is one of those interesting points for folks who maybe don't have a lot of experience within an administration. The big inflection points are the year before an election and the year right at before the end of a term. That's when things begin to churn a little bit more. And this puts a lot of extra burdens on the people who basically are willing to take them on, doesn't it? That's always been the challenge. So how do you and how does your office manage the variety of portfolios in your AOR?
Well, it starts with anchoring to our North Star, which is the National Defense Strategy, which Secretary Austin signed out in 2022. And that makes really clear that the pacing challenge for the department is the People's Republic of China, followed by the acute threat from Russia. We can't lose sight of threats from North Korea, Iran, violent extremist organizations, and then there's a set of transboundary challenges, certainly that we need to navigate, from climate change to pandemics. And so that overall strategic priority setting and framing really guides our work day to day in terms of deciding where we need to place our time, attention, and resources. There are, of course, current events that make that challenging in terms of what may be in the news that day, challenging us around the globe or popping in our inbox. But we do attempt to ensure that we are dedicating principally our time and effort and resourcing on those NDS priorities.
Well, and I guess you put your finger on one of the biggest challenges. When you're talking about homeland defense, and that is the balance between, let's say, preparing and defending against threats, but also preparing society and the government to be resilient for those things that perhaps you were not able to prevent. How do you balance the competing pressures between making sure that nothing bad ever happens versus the pressure to be ready to respond after something bad has happened?
Yeah. And the reality is you have to do both, to be proactive and to deter aggression before it happens. But I think the beauty of the way that we've framed resilience in the National Defense Strategy and subsequent guidance that the Secretary recently signed out on Homeland Defense policy is that resilience actually is a mode of deterrence, that as we are building resilient organizations, people, systems, capabilities, that helps us operate through disruption that our adversaries might choose to throw at us, whether that's through gray zone attacks here in the homeland or abroad, or the prospect of conventional nuclear warfare. If we are resilient and exhibiting resilience day to day, it shows our competitors that they can't challenge us today.
I was thinking precisely about that. You have to be able to show that you're able to do things, because if you don't show that you're able to handle things, then the adversary will think that provides them with an opening. And so you've also talked about the National Defense Strategy priorities and how that's your North Star. Now, the National Defense Strategy, or at least a version of it, is declassified and available to the public. The Homeland Defense Policy Guidance, however, is classified. So what aspects of that guidance fit in with the National Defense Strategy, and how do you harmonize the more sort of classified elements of the Homeland Defense Strategy with the public statements of the National Defense Strategy?
Thanks. And, we're leaning into opportunities like this to talk about the Homeland Defense Policy Guidance, even though it is classified, because we think it's important to be able to convey what those priorities are. And the good news is we do plan to release an unclassified version of it in hopefully the spring timeframe, so we can share more. But to give you a sense of what those priorities are for Homeland Defense that we're really driving through the department right now, It's ensuring that we're deterring aggression, both through direct and indirect cost imposition. And, that builds upon our conventional and nuclear capabilities, both here in the homeland through our nuclear deterrent, but also how we're projecting power forward in the Indo-Pacific, in Europe, around the world. It's really everyone's responsibility to defend the homeland, regardless of what combatant command or service that you work in. And so we wanted to make that clear in the homeland guidance. Another key priority is ensuring continuity of government, fairly humbling responsibilities that we have there, but to ensure that whether it's through those gray zone attacks day to day, that we can function as a government, regardless of what threats or challenges our competitors might throw at us. Another key objective for the HDPG, as we call it, is improving resiliency, as we've already hit on, to ensure that our systems, operations, capabilities, our personnel are building and exercising that resiliency day to day is another core objective. I would say a fourth one is enhancing our chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear capabilities, particularly for the homeland. We also have to have that preparedness overseas, but there are some unique capabilities that are needed here in the homeland for certain crises and contingencies as well. A fifth one is ensuring that we're improving climate resiliency. Extreme weather shocks that unfortunately we've seen wreak havoc at Tyndall Air Force Base, other key locations here in the homeland. Our ability to project power forward to conduct operations here in the homeland, and you know the degrading effects that climate can have over time on our systems and capabilities means that we need to make our installations more resilient to those types of extreme weather shocks. And then I would say the last but not least one to mention is defending critical infrastructure, and specifically defense critical infrastructure. When we think about what are those key nodes, whether they're under DoD ownership or outside the wire, that are necessary for us to be able to mobilize our force flow into theater, it really hinges on, you know, power, telecommunication, water, those key nodes that need to be made more resilient to the types of shocks and attacks that our competitors might seek to make against us.
Okay, let me see. There's a couple of directions I want to go in here, but I want to ask actually a question out of ignorance. And I think our audience might also be curious about this. And that is, what is the relationship? When we talk about homeland defense, what's the relationship between the DoD and the Department of Homeland Security in organizing that homeland defense?
Absolutely. So, you know, the Department of Defense is, you know, mission is to fight and win the nation's wars. And the Department of Homeland Security has a broader mandate statutorily, you know, whether that's for cybersecurity, for, you know, our ports and customs, for a lot of other critical functions of, around the country. Of course, DHS stood up in post-9/11 and carrying a lot of those counterterrorism and law enforcement functions in partnership with DOJ, Department of Justice, and local and state law enforcement. And so there's a really important interrelationship between DOD and DHS in a homeland context. Sometimes the Department of Homeland Security will ask the Department of Defense for resources under defense support of civil authorities to help buttress their operations when they might be overwhelmed or when DoD might have particular capabilities that could be useful for a particular mission. You know, we provide that support, for example, for hurricanes and other domestic events of a natural nature. We also provide that type of support at the Southwest border, have done that for over two decades. But it's a really important distinction in terms of what DoD needs to be focused on going forward, what we're statutorily given the authorities to do, which is for that war fighting purpose. And again, if we hearken back to what are the threats that are facing the country today, you know, PRC being our pacing challenge, acute threat from Russia. We have to be building and investing in those warfighting capabilities while at the same time strengthening the capacity, authorities, and resourcing of our domestic-facing agencies like DHS to be able to fully perform their mission.
So when the new Chief of Staff of the Army was here at the War College, he emphasized the need that to be thinking about warfighting and about building teams. So with that in mind, how do we imagine and how does the DoD manage the competing demands of all of these different impulses of homeland defense, overseas warfighting, defense support of civilian authorities, especially when you work on scenarios where you imagine multiple crises at once? How do we fight a war and defend the homeland and be ready for the next fight too?
It's a great question, and what I can tell you is we are digging deeply into that from an analytic perspective to understand how the most stressing scenarios are going to force us to consider those tensions and trade-offs. You know, the reality is, you know, given the PRC's theory of victory, we know that they're going to try to subvert our force flow mobilization from the homeland to project power forward, at the same time as they may be conducting cyber attacks or, you know, counter-espionage or trying to subvert us more broadly across the homeland that'll put stressors on our civilian authorities. And so the Department of Defense could find itself in a really difficult situation of needing to provide that warfighting capability forward through a contested operating environment while at the same time getting called up by DHS, you know, the White House, DOJ, and others to perform defense support of civil authorities. And we've come to call that the simultaneity challenge, where the very same resources, you know, particularly for the National Guard, are going to get pulled in multiple directions at the same time.
Right. And I guess the only way that you can plan for that is by making sure that you can do all those things at once, I guess.
It is. And, you know, through scenario-based exercises and analysis, we are digging into that right now. But it also requires, frankly, robust discussions within the U.S. interagency to ensure, as we mentioned earlier, that civilian agencies are planning and have the capacity to perform their functions in those types of scenarios as well. So that work is currently underway, but we have a lot more work to do in that regard.
Well, and I guess we've talked about, and you mentioned gray zone problems, and it's one thing to imagine sort of dealing with physical difficulties, but the relationship between physical infrastructure and the threats posed in the cyber realm and in the information space remain very complex. So when we talk about defending the homeland, it also involves defending our ability to understand what's really going on in the world and not to be at the mercy of disinformation or misinformation. And so what are the sort of communication strategies that your office is developing in coordination with other agencies about how we can communicate to the American people what's going on and how we're prepared also for what our adversaries are trying to do or what our adversaries are capable of doing? How do we think about all of that as an information strategy as much as a practical strategy?
The reality is our competitors are already manipulating the information space domestically. We've unfortunately seen that in our elections. We unfortunately, you know, have seen that day to day through social media and other means. It is also shaping the landscape abroad in the Ukraine conflict, in the Middle East, places where, you know, DoD is operationally engaged. So we have been building out our approach to how we use within our DoD authorities ways to better communicate and, in some cases, particularly for Ukraine, downgrade, information that can be shared publicly to get the data and the truth out there in terms of what our competitors are doing. To be able to be more transparent with our partners and allies, with the American public, and ensure that there is then credibility for the steps that we are trying to take in support of our partners and allies in those operations overseas. It gets trickier in a homeland context because, you know, DoD has is structured to have authorities to message abroad, and that is appropriate in our democracy. And so internally to the United States, we want to be transparent through our public affairs platforms in terms of what our plans, our capabilities, our intentions are. But it's really up to other departments and agencies, federal, state, local authorities, civil society, to be able to build out the logic and the reasons why the U.S. government is taking certain actions or certain steps to improve resiliency and to defend the homeland. And so that requires a partnership with the Department of Defense to be able to be transparent about what our U.S. military intentions are and ensuring that we are working in lockstep with our civilian authorities in a domestic context.
And of course, appearing on podcasts like this is part of that strategy.
Yes.
And you mentioned allies and partners, and I'm thinking about this, but you know, we have allies and partners at a variety of levels who themselves have let's say, very different ways of communicating to their publics, and they're very different ways of sharing information. And so to what extent do we coordinate not just the message, but also the ways that the messages get out with allies and partners?
Absolutely. I will tell you that for any given military operation or action that we undertake, there is significant cooperation that we pursue with our allies and partners to ensure that we are aligned in terms of what is going to be stated publicly, particularly when it involves combined operations with our allies and partners, but also in contexts where the U.S. military may be undertaking actions within, a respective partner or ally territory. And so that's really baked into our approach, just as we, are defining what capabilities and what sequence we are going to undertake for the operation itself. We dovetail that with, our public affairs and our allied and partner engagement approach. And that happens at all levels of the Department of Defense, from the Secretary of Defense on down, in terms of reaching out to our allies and partners.
There are, and there's a question that I'd like to ask that I don't know if you can answer it or not, but I guess I'm going to ask it anyway. And that is, if you were to speak directly to the American people and say, the greatest, the most important thing that you as an American citizen can do to contribute to homeland defense, what would that be?
I would say it's probably a couple of things. One is that as you consume information, and wow, we have a lot of sources of information these days, that we're interrogating that information. We are looking at it critically in terms of, is it balanced? What are the sources of that information? And to read widely or consume information widely, to then form a basis of understanding for what might be happening in our world today or here in the homeland. I think that's thing one. Thing two would be, to invest more in time and understanding of what makes our country function. Getting back to civics lessons and, visiting. I, for example, just took my daughter's Girl Scout troop on a visit to the Capitol, and to ensure that we understand what it is that makes our government function, what makes us one people and brings us together. And that may sound kind of old school, but I think if we are able to build that common foundation and resilience at the individual, family, community level, that makes us more resilient to the types of pressures, whether internal or coming from our competitors, that we may well face in the years to come. I think it's also things like basic cybersecurity and ensuring that we're up to date, both at home and in the workplace. It is so easy for our competitors to find holes in the way that we are so interconnected these days and to exploit that. So those would be really three basic things that I would recommend to the American people.
That's a pretty solid argument. And I would say that if somebody who's chosen to serve the government isn't willing to be a little idealistic when it comes to what we're supposed to be doing, then we've really got trouble, right? So it's good to tell the people that we need to realize the things that hold us together. Well, we're entering an election year. And one of the things that makes democracies great is that we are allowed to disagree with each other in public. And there are those, however, who would argue that this is a weakness of democracies in the face of authoritarian states that can be, let's say, more rigorous in their message discipline. How should we, you and I, we both work for Uncle Sam, but how should we, and how should American citizens in general communicate to the broader public how we value debate and discussion and policy disagreements in a way that also emphasizes the fact that we're all trying to make this system work better? So how do we disagree in ways that do not undermine our unity as a nation?
I think it's core to who we are, and you know, from the beginning of our country, to foster that type of debate. You know, a collection of 54 U.S. states and territories that are incredibly diverse. And so, if you take that as a given principle, and then I think the key is really for civil debate that we can acknowledge that we have differences of opinion, but at the end of the day, we are all Americans. We are unfortunately all confronting these threats that we talked about at the outset that the NDS makes really clear. And so, you know, the pathways to address those threats might differ between administrations or political parties, but fundamentally, we all have to be committed to working together to address them through civil dialogue and debate.
I guess that's the best we can hope for, right? Or is it the most important thing we can do to talk about things and talk them through and then figure out what that the debate itself is important? So as a final question in this conversation, when you came to speak to the War College for the Homeland Defense Symposium, you said you were there to deliver a message to the folks who were going to be making strategic decisions going forward. So now, what would you say was the single most important message you wanted to get across to our students that you'd like to make sure also gets included in this conversation for the broader public?
Absolutely. You know, I would emphasize that importance of resilience and the day-to-day actions that any one of us can take to make ourselves more resilient at the individual, community, unit, departmental, you know, country level matters, because if we are demonstrating that resilience day to day through repeatable actions, through, you know, enhanced cybersecurity, to watching where we, you know, place our badge when we leave for the day, but also, you know, through how we bring the various elements of our military together, how we train, how we operate, and demonstrate that resilience day to day, that is sending a message principally to the PRC that today is not the day to test us. And, you know, at the same time, building that warfighting capability so that, you know, we are prepared for what we hope never transpires, but we have to responsibly be prepared to fight and win the nation's wars.
It's one of those paradoxes of deterrence, right? Is that you want to be ready to do something you don't want to have to do. But the best way to make sure that you don't have to do it, or that you're not going to have to do it, is to prepare to do it so well that your adversary believes that you're willing to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Melissa Dalton, thank you very much for your work at the Pentagon, and thank you especially for joining us here on A Better Peace to talk about your office's work and your vision for the future. It's always great when we're able to have the DVs come to Carlisle, and it's even better when we can get them to come on A Better Peace.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
So thanks for joining us today, and thanks to all of you for listening in. Please send us your comments on this program and all the programs, and send us your suggestions for future programs. We're always interested in hearing from you. Please take a moment, if you have not already, and subscribe to A Better Peace. And after you have subscribed to A Better Peace, please rate and review this podcast, because that's how more people can find out about us. We're always interested in growing the community for conversations like this one. And even though this conversation is over, we look forward to welcoming you next time. And so, until next time, from the War Room, I'm Ron Granieri.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.